Welcome to Ideashare. I'm your host, Talika Mehrotra. In today's episode, we dive into some of the most complex and uncomfortable topics in anti-racism with our esteemed guest, DEI expert Ben Ruhler. How can white allies move beyond their comfort zones and commit to the hard work necessary for sustainable change? We'll explore these crucial questions and more, including a real-time teachable moment that challenged and transformed my own understanding. Get ready for an eye-opening and transformative discussion. Let's get started. What a time to be alive.
Thank you so much for being on today. I am beyond excited about this conversation. We had met, I think, just under a year ago, and I brought all my biases to the table. And it was such a breath of fresh air to meet you. And I've been watching your work, and I've been thrilled and honored that you were open to come and chat with us today. So the audience is in for a really awesome conversation today. And so I'm ready to dive right in. So let me tell you about Ben. Ben is the founder and CEO of In the Area Productions, where he supports other white people, especially white men, in progressing in their anti-racism journey. He's also an associate at the Aspen Leadership Group and is a former licensed social worker and executive director who's deeply committed to building workplace cultures where employees of all backgrounds feel supported. He's spoken to audiences throughout the country, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Microsoft World Headquarters, and the Global Engagement Summit. Ben has been recognized as a young American leader at Harvard Business School, received the Social Impact Award from the University of Chicago School of Social Service, and is a graduate of Leadership Tomorrow. He's authored and been interviewed for dozens of media pieces about anti-racism and leadership, and has served 3 years in the International Affiliate Assembly for Points of Light. This is the world's leading organization dedicated to the power of volunteerism. So we are in for a major treat. And thank you, Ben, for being here. This is going to be a blast. So let's dive right in. I wanted to have our audience know a bit more about your personal journey in DEI. So can you tell us about your background a bit more than what I just shared, which is just the tip of the iceberg?
Good morning. And absolutely, I will share. But first, I must correct you. You did get something wrong.
Oh, no.
We have known each other for more than a year. 1 year and 3 weeks, I think.
Oh,
I believe. So we have celebrated our 1 year anniversary of knowing one another. I am also thrilled and honored to be here. You are somebody I deeply admire for your intellect and your humanity and radical candor with which you move through life so honestly. And I think we need more of that. So I'm thrilled to share space with you.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah. As far as my own personal DEI journey, how embarrassing do I want to get here for myself? I would say I have been the kind of quintessential, well-intentioned white dude much of my life. Great values, I think, good morals, dope, justice-minded parents who were amazing examples to me. I was the head of the diversity center in college. I took all the courses that had the word diversity in them. My senior thesis in college was on Steve Biko and the notion of psychological emancipation in post-apartheid South Africa.
Oh my gosh.
I attended all the Black student union meetings. Today, I cringe at the thought of me going to those Black student union meetings. My intentions were great, but my goodness, I think instead of doing the hard and necessary work of interrupting harmful stuff within white circles or, you know, advocating for more institutional change at my predominantly white institution, it was quite frankly easier and safer for me to kind of distance myself from racism, both within white circles and within myself. Like, I'm not that white dude, right? And so I think, you know, my journey to your question, despite really good intentions and values, I have clung deeply to comfort throughout much of my life, decades. I am a recovering conflict averse scaredy cat. I am a recovering conflict averse scaredy cat. And this has been my biggest work during my journey in DEI. What does it mean to like try to be a nice dude and a peacemaker and a bridge builder and also move through spaces at life and at work with courage? Both those things can be true, but it's very difficult. In 2015, I got the privilege of being an executive director of a white-founded, white-led institution in Seattle. Great organization, dope people, very white. And over the 7 years I was there, I had the privilege of working with a really amazing team to, I would say, radically evolve this organization in really brave and bold ways. Policies, practices, culture. And it was really hard at times, excruciating in those early days before we had built trust and norms and kind of going through the fire and taking a good hard look in the mirror on what you're doing well and where you're absolutely coming up short and not doing right by people is really hard. I had a consultant who did a little climate survey for us and did focus groups, and we met at a coffee shop in Seattle. We sat down and she presented me her findings, a hard copy, and she handed it to me. And her first words were, "Ben, it's bleak." That was hard. So, but being part of that case study was beautiful. It was necessary. And it forms a lot of what I talk about in my work now has really been like an inflection point in my own journey around conflict and discomfort and courage.
Well, and I would like to add that we met over a year ago at the Diversity Summit at Northwestern. Right. And what struck me at that conference was that it was brought up a number of times that that conference would actually be illegal to have in many parts of this country. Yeah. And it struck me how much our freedom of speech is being, you know, infringed on right now, just on the topic of diversity. And it was just so alarming to me that we were in an environment that would be illegal in different parts of the country. So to your point about intentions and you know, being comfortable, I think most people have the best of intentions. And I right. think that's where, you know, we can hang up our hope, right? Like, we all have the best of intentions.
Right.
But we unfortunately live in a place of comfort. So recently, you were featured in a Forbes article, and the title of that article was provocative in itself. And so I definitely want to talk about that. It was titled "White Man's Role in Advancing Equity and Inclusion." So we know that most CEOs are still white men, and we know that women are now actively self-selecting out. Can you expand on that article and, you know, just help us understand how allyship can actually be a game changer?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, shout out to local Seattle changemaker and legend Aparna Ray for that beautiful piece in Forbes. Aparna is somebody I learn a lot from. And look, we talk about DEI and JEDI and anti-racism and equity and inclusion and belonging. And these are big sort of abstract concepts, but DEI is not rocket science here. But there is some science to it. Those are the words of Lily Zhang, who I learn a lot from, and encourage everybody to follow them on LinkedIn. I think Lily uses they, them pronoun. Learn a lot from Lily Zhang. And another Seattle legend right here out of Seattle, Ruchika Tulshyan, wrote a book called Inclusion on Purpose, An Intersectional Approach to Creating a Culture of Belonging at Work, which outlines so many like concrete things we can do every day to be allies or advance inclusion in our workplace. And again, some of this is not rocket science, right? Like, send candidates the interview questions prior to the interview so that the interview doesn't bias extroverts, right? No. Have men take meeting notes so that stuff like office housework or whatever you want, term one might want to use, doesn't default to women. There are lots of little things and big things we can do every day that are concrete, actionable, to build more inclusive workplaces. And it takes time and money.
Yeah.
Time and money. And I always say to my clients and anybody I'm talking to, let's not claim something's a priority if it's not reflected in the time and money we are spending on it. And I love that article that Aparna wrote where she interviewed me and four other white dudes to talk about concrete things we have been doing and can do in workplaces to distribute power, build inclusive workplaces, get out the way, and really change policies, practices, and culture. Because as you said, good intentions are not enough. Yep. I've been most of my career in the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. I love the nonprofit sector, and we have great intentions and typically value diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. Look at the makeup, racial demographics of board members in the United States of America. When I was in high school a long time ago, 86% of board members in this country were white. Fast forward like 25, 30 years, it's basically the same, 84%. It's not because people don't want more diverse boards. If you ask most board chairs in the country, they'll say, we value diversity, we want more diverse boards. It's not changing because of systemic barriers. And that's what we have to be intentional and look into, because the good intentions are not enough.
And what would you say is holding people back? Because, I mean, we can make our own observations. We can make our own, you know, our own biased opinions, right? Like, oh, people are clinging to power and they don't want to share. But what is that one biggest thing that's stopping this from actually working or happening? Why are we at 84% from, you know, X number of years ago? What is right. it? Is it fear? Is it ego? What's holding us up, in your opinion?
That's a great question. I think a lot of leaders, and especially white people, have had the privilege of comfort. And acting with courage is exciting and it's rewarding and it's really hard, because we can't please everybody. And I see a lot of organizations and leaders get stuck when they're all about inclusion or DEI until it comes time to do things differently, because change is scary. And part of our work as leaders and white people and those of us with privilege is to ask, who and what are we willing to walk away from? And how much risk do we have an appetite for? That's really hard. Especially when you're somebody like me who takes those Strength Finder Gallup polls, and 100% of the time, my number one value is harmony.
Yeah.
Harmony. I want everybody to be happy. Like, it ain't that complicated. Let's just vibe and do good work. We all want this mission here. But what happens when you have board members who are pushing back? What happens when you have donors who are pushing back? What happens when there's turnover on staff? What happens when you don't have the budget for this, that, and the other? Like, this takes courage. And it's really hard. And so I think that is where we have had a little bit of a failure of imagination and creativity, because the status quo is simply not doing right by everybody. There are much better, brighter, bolder ways for us to operate. But when we haven't had experience with that, it feels very scary. So to your question, I do think fear is a big part of that, because we want to advance a DEI or agenda of inclusion so long as we're still comfortable and safe and feel comfortable. Yeah. And that's hard. I want to bring everybody along with love. I want to meet them where we're at. I have curiosity. We're all on our own journey. And at the end of the day, if we are centering the people with privilege or power, and our work is to bring them along at the expense of progress, let's not say we're advancing an inclusive agenda. Right. And that's what I did for many years as an executive director, kind of beat my head against the wall trying to get, you know, so-and-so or board members or others up to speed and where we're at. In the meantime, you see women of color cycling in and out of the organization at a much higher rate than their white counterparts. And if you're going to say we're going to center those people or employees closest to the margin or closest to the pain or closest to the problem, then do that. And understand that there may be some collateral damage that, again, you try to work through with love and curiosity. But at the end of the day, we can't please everybody. And so a lot of my work in the area of productions is supporting white people to access our courage in perpetuity. And part of that means having radical love and grace for ourselves. Uh-huh. So we can show up with grace for ourselves and shed our perfectionism and people pleasing and try to do right for the rest of our lives, knowing that nothing we do will ever be quite right or just enough, nevertheless vitally important.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I heard Adam Grant, the Wharton professor, make a comment once that about DEI, saying most people, there's two routes. You will either do, you know, what's right or what's wrong, and nobody is going to do what's wrong. The reality is there's another option, and that is to do nothing. And that's unfortunately where a lot of corporations exist, because it's easier. And so that's the unfortunate reality. But I do want to talk about some of your clients, because you've had some very interesting people that you have worked with and have been lucky to work with you. So we recently heard some really strong comments by NFL kicker Harrison Butker. I'm not going to repeat them, but it was about a woman's place in society as homemakers and wives. And what I found so startling about this is the irony is his own mother is a highly, highly accomplished medical physicist at the University of Emory Medical School. So you have worked with the NFL. And I wanted to understand your thoughts on DEI and sports and how they shape our cultural narrative.
Those comments at that graduation made me sad. Not just cringeworthy and saddening, but dangerous.
Yeah.
I got the opportunity to work with the DEI heads of all 32 NFL franchises and the heads of DEI for the NFL, just really great people. But talk about tough jobs, my goodness. I think the average tenure for a DEI lead at an NFL franchise is like a year and a half, right? These jobs are really, really hard no matter what sector you're in. Now, regarding sports, okay, first, I'm a lifelong athlete myself, right? I was a captain of the soccer team. I coach basketball. I still hoop every Saturday.
Right.
I think I went 10 for 24 last week. A few air balls, but overall a great shooting day, but I digress. But there's a lot we can learn about curiosity, community, open-mindedness, cross-cultural communication from sports, right? But that's another conversation. I think at the end of the day, though, sports, right, are workplaces, NFL, higher ed, and like many workplaces in America, like my sector, the nonprofit sector, the higher you go, the whiter you get, right? We talked about the racial demographics on nonprofit boards. You see the same in Pac-12 coaching. You see it in the NFL, coaches, front office, ownership. Now, I think the NFL represents the belly of American capitalism and in some ways toxic masculinity, right? Ijeoma Oluo's book, Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America, has a great chapter on the NFL and its roots in this country that I highly encourage all of your listeners to read. Again, the book is called Mediocre. But because of this, I think the NFL, for example, can be a great sort of testing ground for workplace cultural overhauls, right? Well, and I like to look at one of the franchises, the Washington Commanders out of D.C. They had a toxic workplace on many levels. And you don't have to take my word for it. Just Google it. You know, anybody who knows anything about the NFL knows what that organization has been plagued with over the last decade plus. Misogyny, lack of trust from fans, you know, losing record, lawsuits, and on, right? Then comes Jason Wright, youngest president at the time, 3 or 4 years ago in the NFL, the first black president in the history of the league. And he undertakes a massive intentional cultural overhaul of the Washington Commanders. Mm-hmm. And that involves significant staff turnover, embedding into, you know, leaders' review process, the people stuff, right? There's like a third of their review is around the people management and culture, and that ties to bonuses and all that stuff. Now the Commanders a few years later have, I think, the most diverse executive team in the NFL in terms of gender and race. It's translating to business. Their suite sales are up, sponsorships are up, season tickets are up, right? Fans are coming back. Representation matters. And I think we can look actually at spheres like the NFL and be like, wow, okay, if they can do some of this here, what might be possible? Yeah. Also at the Commanders, you have a woman named Chanel S. Reynolds who runs DEI for the Commanders, doing amazing work regarding increasing female and woman of color representation in careers and sports, right? And what Chanel is doing in terms of partnering with HBCUs and building these employee engagement teams is just phenomenal around, you know, ongoing transformational relationships, right, in the long haul to increase representation. And So to your question, I think some of these sports workplaces, while they can be the most toxic and outdated, can also offer us the best case studies in these workplace overhauls, right? Because they're true testing grounds. Yeah. And there are people like Jason Wright and the Commanders who we can learn from. And what I want to see is more elevation of these case studies so we can all learn from this.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love that. And you just made a comment about, you know, some of this work being tied to bonuses. And this is what Lily Zeng talks about, because she creates frameworks. And as you said, this is not rocket science. And it's also not just a nice to have. McKinsey has proven study after study that this is good for business. This is actually impacting your bottom line. And it's in your best interest for your employees, for your talent, for your business to make this work. But that it should be, incentives should be tied to KPIs, that it should be measurable. And so that brings me to my next question about what key factors really determine whether a DEI initiative will have lasting impact. Unfortunately, we live in a time of box checking and, you know, performative culture, right? And so there's a lot of PR out there about what organizations are doing, and there's not so much follow through, and there's hardly any sustainability on that. So really, what is it that you have seen that are the key factors that determine that this initiative will have a lasting impact within an organization?
Great. Happy to answer that. First, I'm going to try to model in real time here my own discomfort. I think Lily's pronouns are they, them.
Oh, my apologies. I'm so sorry. I did that twice already. Lily, if you're listening, I'm so sorry about that.
No, let's learn in real time. But see, again, this is where I talk about interrupting white silence. Even something so simple like that makes me uncomfortable. I don't want to offend you. I don't want you to think I'm,
and you know, should offend me, and I'm open to it. And this is a great learning for anyone who's listening right now. I don't mean to offend anyone. I don't mean to hurt them. I have no intention of that. And look how quickly I learned. And by the way, I knew this. I forgot.
And again, as leaders, how are we demonstrating radical humility in real time and modeling that? We all make mistakes. We all have biases. We all have racism. We all say things and commit microaggressions and whatnot. And the goal is to not be perfect. The goal is to do better, trend in the right direction, and have radical humility as we receive feedback and learn.
Well, and I really want to highlight this moment right now for anybody who is listening. It doesn't feel good to get feedback that says you are doing something wrong. It doesn't feel good. Even if your intentions are, I would never want to hurt anyone. I would never want to hurt someone who's doing good work, who is literally a leader in their field. And yet I'm so appreciative that you stopped me twice in this podcast to actually help me remember that. And so I want that to be a lesson, not just for me, but it is absolutely fine to take feedback. It doesn't hurt that much. It feels actually pretty good after the fact. So thank you, Ben.
Okay. Thanks for modeling. Receiving
my apologies, Lily, if I'm, you know, if I have the luck of you hearing this podcast, but thank you.
Look, this is good that we're talking about Lily Zeng, because a lot of what Lily talks about, to your question about, you know, what does lasting impact mean, is what you talked about, right? How are we embedding this work into the organization in a way that is beyond just the people who happen to care about this the most are doing something and then they leave and it's not institutionalized, right? What are we measuring? The quantitative stuff, the qualitative stuff. How are we embedding diversity, equity, inclusion into the policies, practices, and culture of an institution in perpetuity in a way that can be held accountable? And that this is not an other or a siloed separate thing, but foundation to our business, foundation to the mission, our vision, or our values is diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Lily and other leaders in our sector have books on this. They lead classes and courses on this. There is amazing leadership here. We don't have to make it up. But again, it takes time and money to invest in doing this in the long run. And in this Western culture where we're always too busy and it's more, 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 go, 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 the sense of urgency, it's really hard to create the time and the budget to do this. We have to fight against these, dare I say, white supremacy culture, you know, pace to slow down and build trust and do our homework. And there are incredible leaders that companies can pay to come guide them through this work.
Mm-hmm.
Lily, they're out of Seattle alone. Dr. Caprice Hollins and her team at Cultures Connecting are crushing this.
Mm-hmm.
Lindsay T.H. Jackson, LTHJ Global, Google LTHJ Global and Lindsay T.H. Jackson. Incredible resources that companies and organizations can hire to build these accountability mechanisms into an organization's DEI efforts in a way that will have lasting change. I'm working with an organization in the STEM field right now that is being so thoughtful about how DEI is woven into their new strategic plan. It's not some separate bullet over here. It's woven into everything they're planning to do in the next 3.5 years.
Yeah. And I think the big issue, at least that I experienced when I was going through my certification at Northwestern as well, is that there is literally no standards. Anybody can say I'm a DEI expert and just jump in. And so thank you for pointing out some of these amazing resources. And by the way, you as well. So let me remind everybody that Ben is an extraordinary resource. The one thing that's striking me is that we live in such an environment of being politically correct that we are afraid to use words that might make other people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Your use of the word white man and just saying white people, that in itself could be provocative. And I just find it very interesting that we live in an environment where we can't even use the words to do the work without offending somebody. And that you know, is tough. So let me ask you a question about some of the projects that you've done. Can you highlight one that really, really stayed with you, that hit home for you, that maybe didn't work out and it was just heartbreaking, or that was just such a home run that you wish that you could see more of that? I'd love to hear about that.
Well, I'm a strength-based guy, so let's start with the positive.
Absolutely.
We had a consultant named Toy Sing Wu. At the time, her company was New Directions Consulting, I believe, in Seattle, who came to work with our organization. And she told us, you need to name your culture. You need to name your cultural norms at your workplace. And that was simple but powerful. Culture is very nebulous. We don't often name our cultural norms at work, yet any new hire who comes in will pretty quickly pinpoint, oh, this is the culture, this is the vibe. But there's a lot of guessing that happens at work. So we started going into conference rooms and having tedious, boring, but important meetings about what are our cultural norms?
Mm-hmm.
If I send you an email, what is the expectation about how quickly you will respond? That is culture, but we don't often name that.
Right?
What if you're in a meeting and it runs long? Can you bounce? Do you have to stick around? Like, that's culture, dress code, working from home, all these things. And this helped ensure that we were all operating from the same norms and that it wasn't a guessing game, because when it's that guessing game, that usually benefits people who look like me or whose parents or close associates worked in a similar professional setting. So I think naming a team or an institution's culture is really important, but it takes time, and somebody leaves and new people come and you got to get them up to speed. So I do think that was really a powerful initiative we undertook that significantly improved the transparency of how we were all operating. So it was less of a guessing game.
Amazing. I love that. Do you want to speak to any of the, I mean, we know all the challenges, but is there anyone in particular that surprised even you?
Oh gosh. Challenges that went awry. I just remember having a colleague tell me to my face, Ben, we're all talk. She said, I'm glad we're talking about this stuff. At the time, you know, 2016-ish, give or take a year, it was more than a lot of other white leg organizations were doing. It was all talk. And that stung. I'm human. I told you I value harmony. I want people to love me and be happy. And I don't know that I acted super defensive, but internally I was very defensive. Like, do you understand how hard I'm trying? You're raging against, I'm not saying these things, but I'm thinking these things, right? You're raging against the wrong machine. I'm on your side. Like, you know how hard it is to change the culture of an organization? I'm trying, right? Me.
Yeah.
That's what we do. We make, you know, I took these criticisms as a personal indictment into me as a leader and a human, instead of just sitting with it and embracing that non-closure and that discomfort and having radical humility and shedding my defensiveness and not making it about me. And I think this is where my biggest work has come and where I think a lot of white men need to do better is radical humility, not acting from a place of defensiveness and centering ourselves all the time. Like, okay, so what can we do to change these systems over time, right? Things can suck in the short term or the long term, right? And so what can we do now, the hard stuff now that we will be thankful for later? And so I think where I used to really fail was not being able to sit with the conflict or the disagreement or the imperfection and really centering myself when it wasn't about me. And that's what we need to do more of, especially white people and white men. Like, it's not about us all the time.
Yeah, but that doesn't feel good, Ben, right?
Like, it doesn't.
It's not about me.
It sucks.
Sorry,
it sucks. That's why I talk to people all the time about what are you doing to invest in radical love for yourself?
Yeah.
Therapy, exercise, meditation, intimacy, community, you know, all these things, you know, spirituality, what, you know, friendships, because we need to commit to dismantling these harmful systems in perpetuity until we die. This is intergenerational work that will not be solved in our lifetime. And so if we're going to do this in the long haul, then we have to have grace for ourselves and one another. And that's where I bring my social work background in. And I don't think it's fluffy. I know it sounds cheesy, but like, how are we loving ourselves? That's why I loved your first podcast. Shout out to all the listeners who are listening. You need to listen to that first podcast, that talk that you gave at Chief. Is that the name of the organization? Beautiful, powerful, candid, human, deeply human journeys, because we're all struggling.
Yeah.
We're all struggling, even on the good days. And so we have to invest in radical love and grace for ourselves and those around us so we can do this in the long haul. And I'm a little embarrassed, but the fact is a lot of us white people got to go a long part of our lives without really understanding how deeply flawed and racist this country is. We got a little bit of a pass in terms of this visceral discomfort. And now it's a kind of awakening, like, oh my God. And it's hard to sit with this. It sucks. Like, oh my God, this is really, really scary and dangerous. So, okay.
Sometimes it's easy to look the other way, right?
Absolutely. And we can't look the other way, but not looking the other way means having courage and doing hard things and embracing a lot of discomfort. And if we're going to do that without breaking, we have to take care of ourselves and one another.
Yeah.
Therapy was the number one thing I did to invest in my DEI journey. The number one thing was going to therapy of all the stuff, the basketball, the friends, the trainings, everything. Therapy helped me shed my perfectionism, accept myself as a beautifully flawed work in progress, and changed everything for me.
So you are bringing up something that is not often discussed in DEI. It is not an isolated vertical. This is about the entire landscape. If you don't love yourself, if you don't know yourself, if you don't have a social network, if you don't have an environment where you feel included, and we're not talking about DEI, it just amplifies the problems within the DEI space. And that's an extremely important point to be made. But we live in an environment of otherness, right? And I think the Surgeon General said that isolation is as bad as smoking at this point. It's become an epidemic. And so we live in an environment where we are all really struggling. And your point about therapy, I love it. But unfortunately, people don't have access to it. And
right.
So there are other ways that people need to look to find that self-love and that self-discovery. But what you are mentioning without outright saying it about DEI professionals, and I want to highlight this point, is burnout.
Yeah.
Right? The people who are trying to do the good work, the weight on their shoulders is unbelievable. It's not fair. It's not fair, the amount of work that pure DEI professionals are being asked to do. It's a systemic problem, and one person is not going to be able to change it for the entire organization. So I want to talk about burnout, but I also want to bring in what's happening in our technological world right now, how AI could potentially help us, right? So we're seeing a little bit of experimentation in mental health, how there may be a way to start to that first filter to help people get through with potentially a robot and then see a human after that. Do you think AI is going to be a tool that may potentially help in the DEI vertical as well?
I have no idea. I don't know. I'm skeptical, but I don't know enough. I'm curious. I talk a lot about creativity and having an open mind and taking risks. So I'm open. I'm a late adapter. And I think, you know, capitalism in our culture really centers the individual. And I think the true liberation and change is going to come from the collective being there for one another as humans, healing as humans, supporting one another in mutual aid type of human connectedness, where we look out for one another in new and powerful ways. And I am not convinced that AI can get us there, but I am not an expert. I'm seeing people like Philip Dang with a group called Grantable doing some really cool stuff around, you know, grant writing and AI in a way that's helpful. So I'm open and I'm learning. But to your question, I really don't know. I am seeing some really cool trends in the, you know, different fields that excite me, but I don't know about AI.
I don't think anyone knows, truthfully. Yeah. I don't think anyone really knows. There are alarmists everywhere, and there's optimists. And so hopefully we'll land somewhere in the middle. Right. So as the industry is transforming into DEI 2.0, after George Floyd, there was a big influx of you know, initiatives and interest and time and money, exactly what we needed. Mm-hmm. That has really, there's been a backlash to that recently. Are there new perspectives or strategies in DEI that you are currently excited about or advocating for beyond what was already happening?
Oh, there's a lot that I'm like super fired up and excited about. There's some dope stuff happening across our country. Like, don't sleep on some of these leaders around here doing amazing things and changing the game that we can learn from. You know, one is around shared leadership. Right. Yes. Like this whole model of kind of one person in power, one CEO, this top down stuff doesn't have to be the case all the time. There are some beautiful practices evolving around shared leadership, distributed leadership. I think some of the groundbreaking work in this country is coming out the Bay Area. You got people like Cad Smith, who is a legend. He's done some work with Compass Point. Compass Point does great stuff. I think there will be a statue made of CAD at some point, Ananda Valenzuela out of the Seattle area, the Sustainable Economies Law Center out of Oakland. I love learning from them. They've done some great work with things like a sample board resolution for a worker self-directed organization, right? Like really operationalizing what this future could look like and what does it mean to change things. We just don't have to do things out of history and habit. There are new ways. Brilliant leaders making it easier for us. We just need to spend time and money doing our homework. So one of those trends is around shared leadership. You're seeing a lot more of that in the nonprofit sector now. Maybe two co-leaders or three co-directors or four distributing decision-making power, even if there's still a hierarchy, having a lot more clarity around how decisions are made. Another trend I love, especially in the nonprofit sector, is around community-centric fundraising. Mm-hmm. Right, really looking at some of these old, outdated, archaic, and quite frankly, harmful power dynamics between donors and funders that's really robbing donors of authentic relationships with the missions. And it can be done so much better. And so there's this whole community-centric fundraising movement that's so beautiful and powerful that looks at all of us, the donors, the board, the staff, the volunteers, as equal partners in this mission. And you get people like Andrea Arenas, again, out of Seattle. I'm very biased, but there is some national leadership coming out of Seattle. I'm telling you, don't sleep on the Northwest. You know, Andrea Arenas Consulting, right? She helps organizations embed these 10 principles of community-centric fundraising, one of which is like having tough conversations with donors. Right? And it's a powerful thing that can actually bring us closer together that we have often shied away from. We named a priority of my organization something like interrupting white silence, that we're going to share our anti-racist objectives with everybody. So if I'm out to lunch with a rich white male donor who may lean one way politically or something, I'm not sort of code switching or watering down what we're doing. If we're submitting a proposal to the Gates Foundation, we're not, you know, watering down what we're doing. And that's hard. But again, we named it at our organization that this is a priority for us. And so then it became like, okay, now this is part of my job. This is embedded into how we roll, right? Mm-hmm. Every white person on staff, for example, had a responsibility to interrupt microaggressions when they happen, right? And this is part of the culture we're building.
And it's a part of learning.
Absolutely.
Everything that I have read and everything that I see, the most successful people tend to be the most curious, right?
Absolutely.
The most curious people love to be interrupted and corrected and to keep learning new things. And so it's about self-growth. So I love that. I love that. So right now we've been talking a lot about, self-accountability. But what policies do you think are essential, do you believe are essential for organizations to implement to create an inclusive workplace? Like, where do we really have to start to focus our attention on the policy side?
Yeah. Well, I think let's not shy away from pay and benefits, right? Family leave, flexible work environments, and pay and benefits that support working parents, pay living wages. Like, let's start there. If we're not having some living wages, then it's hard to talk about inclusion beyond that. Other policies, we implemented a racial grievance policy that was in addition to harassment policies and whatnot, a racial grievance policy, which we kind of had to figure out how to do. I think that sent a powerful message to people in our sphere, staff, volunteers, community partners, that we acknowledge that racial harm happens and we are not afraid to talk about it and have accountability when it does. I think policies around how we're hiring in equitable manners set the tone for everything. Like I said, some of this is not rocket science. You know, how are we reviewing applications? How are we conducting interviews? Are we sending questions to candidates in advance so that interviews don't bias, you know, or, you know, unfairly bias extroverts? I think there's other policies around things like showing the salary on job descriptions. That's even bigger than the institution itself, but there's a whole movement now to show the salary, because when we don't, it disproportionately negatively impacts women and people of color if we're not transparent about at least what the pay range is for a job. Again, none of this is rocket science, but there's all these things we can do to build more inclusive workplaces.
Right. So I was lucky enough to take the Northwestern training in leading with diversity, equity, and inclusion with the very brilliant Dr. Alvin Tillery.
Oh, man, how brilliant is that, dude?
He is a powerhouse.
We know each other.
That's how we know each other. Exactly. That's how he put on that extraordinary summit. But I took his class, and I remember thinking, I'm a woman of color. I know everything. Mm. And I went into it with blinders on, and I came out of it so activated. I cracked a tooth because I was grinding.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
My dentist was like, what did you do? I'm like, I'm taking this class.
I hope you sent Dr. Tillery the invoice for that.
No, I was just so grateful to have the opportunity to learn on a level like that, right? To really have access to that kind of information. And that's why my little slip up here about Lily is so embarrassing, because I know this and I've learned it. And it's really important for us to point out that this takes repetition. This takes practice. This takes living it, right? So my question to you is, what kinds and types of DEI training or professional development have you found to be the most effective in changing mindsets and behaviors?
Yeah. Well, I am skeptical of one-off trainings. I think they absolve us of responsibility. People show up, feel like they've checked something off, and there's no real accountability. Mm-hmm. In my work with white people, again, I'm working mostly with, somebody used the term yellow lights and green lights. Yes, I will every now and then try to convince somebody that racism is real and, have that talk. But I'm mostly working with the people who at least on a one-on-one level acknowledge that racism is real and permeates everywhere. We can do better, and that our current status quo is just not doing right by everybody. So at least the good intentions are there. But now what? And what I've seen work with my work with white people specifically is work to really humanize us, to get us out of our head, to shed our perfectionism. Because what happens is we get so scared about saying the wrong thing that we just cling to silence and comfort. And that doesn't do right by anybody. So I lead a lot of white anti-racism groups. Some people call them white caucus meetups. Some people have a problem with that term and call them white anti-racism groups, white ally groups. I don't really care what you call them. It's white people talking about processing our feelings in a way that's not causing harm in multiracial spaces and really looking at, you know, our opportunities to build more inclusive workplaces that will benefit everybody, including us. And I think a lot of the stuff I've seen work is where we do kind of what you and I are doing, is really get personal and share that we're all works in progress. So I do a thing where I have everybody go around. It's mandated. Nobody can pass, where we have to share two things. Share a time that you caused a microaggression, right? Put your foot in your mouth. And what did you say? How did it feel? What did you learn from it? And share another time when you saw that happen with somebody else and you didn't say anything. That's a really powerful exercise, because what happens is you see people, even those people you think got it all figured out or the wokest of the woke, sharing very vulnerably the harm that they have caused. And it gives us permission to remember, like, we're all causing harm. But how are we waking up tomorrow? How do we have the right, giving ourselves permission to wake up tomorrow better than we are today? And so I think where I have worked with white people to really look at those feelings and say, like, it's not about being perfect all the time. It's having the radical humility to grow and evolve and not only cause less harm, but, you know, do better. I've seen that be powerful for people. And I've seen it where we talk about in real life, what you talked about is how hard it is to do brave things, how it can take a toll on our mental and physical health, and and why those lifelines of peer support groups or therapy or friends or otherwise are so important.
I've had the opportunity now over the last few years to talk with DEI professionals who are working at major corporations. And I met a woman who had worked at Google for a number of years, and she just burned out. And then she went to another major organization. And then she went to a major media publication, and she kept coming back because she knew the work was so important, but she was having to leave to just heal herself.
Yeah.
And it just struck me that we are doing this to our people. It shouldn't have to be this way. So let's talk about measurement. Let's talk about how we measure success. There's the intangibles. There's obviously employee retention, all of that. But how do you want to measure the success of DEI initiatives that you've led or consulted on? And what metrics are you finding to be the most telling?
Well, one thing I think we need to ask is, are Black women referring people in their network to apply for jobs at your company?
Yeah.
That's not the end all be all, but that's a pretty telling response. People are being crushed, especially Black women, not only Black women, but especially Black women, crushed by these harmful workplace environments. So I think one thing we need to ask is, are Black women referring people in their network to apply for jobs at our companies? And I think, you know, asking people, this concept of targeted universalism that Lily Zhang and others talk a lot about, right? Okay, let's say we want 90% of our employees to feel a sense of belonging at work. Okay, here's where we're at right now at 75%. But when you start to segment that out, you realize our Indigenous or Latina employees are at 45%. So what targeted things can we do to get everybody up to that 90%? Because that's going to benefit everybody. I think some of those demographic metrics can be very important and illuminating. And that term targeted universalism is one I'm growing to understand and appreciate more. And those types of questions. Do you feel psychologically safe at work?
No.
where you can share thoughts with senior leadership present without fear of retaliation. And then looking at that, you know, segmented out. I think these are some measures of DEI initiatives that can be very telling for organizations.
Yeah, and exceedingly uncomfortable. Because when the answer is no, my Black female colleagues are not comfortable referring that. That doesn't feel great. So,
this is what I coach a lot of people on. Excuse me for interrupting. This is what I help people understand when they are feeling crappy at this early stage, looking in the mirror. I say, but this is the work. Radical humility to have the courage to take a temperature check of where you're at, because now you have a baseline of where, you know, where you need to go from. People don't want to go through the fire because it sucks. But to ask and then to say, this is what we heard, close those feedback loops, this is what we're going to do, and this is what we're going to measure, sends a very powerful message. And I think very few people expect employers to be perfect or have it all figured out. They want to know, are you serious about this? And are you trending in a direction that makes sense? When we used to interview people for jobs, some people say, well, yeah, we want more diversity on our team, but we don't want some, you know, we don't want a Black woman to come in here and feel all this harm if we're not, you know, quite evolved yet. And it's like, you know what? That's not for us to say. Let's be radically transparent about where we are, where we're not, where we're going, what we're doing, what we've learned, and let them make the decision as to whether that is a good fit for them. Again, this radical transparency and radical honesty will set us free. But the hardest part is going through the fire in the beginning. And I see so many leaders just so deflated. And I say, I know it sucks. I know that feedback is really hard to sit with and it does not feel good. But you know what? The fact that you are asking and listening and spending time and money to improve that, that is the work. Bravo. Let's celebrate that win. You were brave enough to do what a lot of organizations don't. And that's even stare yourselves in the mirror.
Yeah, and I love that. And I think a big thing that people fear is that they need to boil the ocean, right? Mm. And as long as you're taking baby steps or any steps, you're already doing the work. So I love that you're pointing that out. So as we wind up, I want to ask you, and I know you've answered this in so many words, but let's leave our listeners with something really beautiful and poignant. What are your goals for the future of DEI? Where we can all work together, both within your network and the broader movement, what would you like to see happen?
I would like to see us dream, get hella creative, experiment, iterate. There is such a world of possibility, but like we talked about, change is very hard and we need more courage. The status quo is failing us. I just read Ijeoma Oluo's book, Be a Revolution. I want all of us to be worthy of a chapter in that book, right? Our liberation is tied together. We can heal. We can honor our shared humanity. But again, changing these deeply embedded systems is intergenerational work. And so my goal is that those of us alive now, here on Earth for this finite amount of time, can act with courage and creativity and conviction to do things in new ways. And that's scary. It's risky, but it's also liberating, these new ways of operating. And I hope that we can do this with radical grace and love for ourselves and one another while we experiment. For my own work and my own, you know, practice, I want to help white people embrace this courage, step into it, let go of our relationship to comfort and perfectionism at all costs, so I can help white people evolve in a much faster way than me that took decades on this journey, right? How do we activate this courage and have the ability to influence our spheres? Like, what a gift to get to be on our deathbeds and be like, you know what? I tried and I helped bend this arc in the right way.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing to get to be a part of. There is so much opportunity there. And I really am hopeful.
Yeah. And what I hear you saying is that the pie is huge, right?
There's
only this much and we can only share these few slices. The pie just keeps getting bigger. The more people that are included, we have more resources to share. And so it's not
absolutely,
it's not a mutually exclusive kind of a thing. Ben, yeah. I am so, so grateful for your time. This
was fun.
And the work that you're doing is so critical. audiences often need to see themselves in their speakers, right? And so some of the work that you do, somebody like me can't talk to those audiences. Right. And so the work that you do is just so, so important. And you're just a beautiful human being as well.
Thank you for taking the time. Oh my gosh.
I adore your work. I'm so glad that we met. And again, thank you for being with us today.
Feelings are mutual. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Idea Share. I hope you found our deep dive into anti-racism and the challenges of moving beyond comfort zones both enlightening and hopefully inspiring. Remember, true change requires us to embrace discomfort and commit to ongoing learning and action. I hope you'll take what you've heard today and apply it in your own journey towards equity and justice. For more impactful conversations, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Until next time, keep sharing ideas and keep pushing boundaries. I'm Talika. See you next time.